tenor James Valenti and conductor Marco Armeliato are backstage at Lyric.
The challenge with Puccini, in my opinion, is always the orchestra, because there are some moments where the orchestra is so thick, so thickly orchestrated, and no matter who you are, I don't care how big your voice is, they will bury you, you know? And it's great to have such a wonderful conductor that's sensitive to that, but if you don't have the right kind of instrument, it's easy to really get too heavy in the middle voice for Puccini.
Not because I'm Italian, but I think the Italian language is very special in the way you say the things. I mean, you can say the same sentence in so many different ways and means different mentality and different. I mean, it's so rich, our language.
Welcome to another edition of Backstage at Lyric. This time, we present an audio transcript of the Discovery Series session for Madama Butterfly by Giacomo Puccini. The Discovery Series consists of panel discussions with the singers, directors, conductors, and other creative talent from the Lyric Opera season. There's usually one session per opera, and they generally take place a few days prior to the opening of each production. For more information about the Discovery Series, including ticket information, visit lyricopera.org. And now we turn things over to Lyric Opera of Chicago dramaturg Roger Pines, your moderator for this Discovery Series session for Madama Butterfly. Roger?
I'm very glad to say that our brilliant leading man and conductor of this production are with us. They both made their Lyric debuts in last night's opening performance, so I want to say to them once again, bravi, and to wish them in bocca lupo for all the rest of the performances. Our Pinkerton American tenor, James Valenti, is returning to the Met this season in this same role. He's also singing Don Carlo of Verdi at Austin Lyric Opera and the title role of Argento's The Dream of Valentino at the Minnesota Opera. Pinkerton has actually brought him to many major theaters, including Covent Garden, the Opéra National de Paris, the Semperoper in Dresden, the Opernhaus Zurich, and San Francisco Opera. New York's 2013 Caramore Festival, he debuted as Don Carlo, actually Don Carlos, because he sang the original French version of Verdi's opera. Among his other major achievements have been his debuts in Rome and at La Scala as Rodolfo, Alfredo at the Met, Covent Garden, and the Salzburg Festival, Maurizio and Adriana Lecouvreur in Washington, Werther in Paris, Faust at Covent Garden, and Edgardo in Sydney. And he received the very prestigious Richard Tucker Award in 2010. Highlights this season for our Italian conductor Marco Armeliato include La Boheme in Munich, Sonnambula at the Met, and La Fanciulla del West in Zurich. He has very close associations with the Met and San Francisco Opera, and he's led productions at Covent Garden, major houses of Vienna, Paris, and Monte Carlo, among many others. His work can be heard on CD in remarkable collaborations with such artists as Renee Fleming, Luciano Pavarotti, Jonas Kaufmann, and Joseph Calea. And among the many productions conducted by Maestro Armeliato that have been released on DVD are the Met's productions of La Rondine with Angela Gheorghiu and Lucia di Lammermoor with Anna Netrebko. So please join me in welcoming to the Discovery Series James Valenti and Marco Armeliato. When, in the course of your lives as performers, did you decide that you wanted to explore Puccini repertoire? When did it come?
To me?
Yes.
Good evening, everybody. Oh, well, I didn't really decide to conduct in Puccini. It happened.
So many composers that was undervalued, like I told you, Mascagni, Leoncavallo, and so many. That's only we know for one opera, like Mascagni, Cavalleria, Leoncavallo, Pagliacci, and Zandonai, Francesca da Rimini. That's it. But over that, we have so many music in Italy. And fortunately, I have the privilege to conduct in the Puccini that obviously is the more finest composer in that epoca, in that time in Italy. And to me, of course, conducting these beautiful scores like Butterfly on this occasion, Tosca, Manolisco, Fanciulla, it's an honor and a privilege. And every time as I fell in love with the composer and the score, the conducting.
James, you came to Puccini quite early.
I did. I actually, I got a recording of La Boheme with Pavarotti and Freni and Voncarian. And it was the time I was very young. I was really beginning. I didn't really speak much Italian, but something about that opera just kind of like, whoa, I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to sing this music. And I was very fortunate, yeah, when I was about 25, I made my debut singing La Bohème in Rome. And I remember the time, I'm like, what am I doing here, you know? And yeah, Puccini's always had a special place. My mother has a CD that she still listens to. It's called Puccini and Pasta. And it's like a, it's just like a greatest hits, you know, O mio bambino caro and all these famous arias. And so Puccini's always had a real, I've always had a real affinity for Puccini. And
were you not listening to it when you were a kid?
No, not really. No, I mean, we knew a little bit, I mean, Mario Lanza kind of things, but I didn't really pay attention, really. You know, I had a family friend who listened to a lot of opera and Pavarotti, but I didn't really pay much attention to it. I played sports and did other things, you know, so.
Once you started singing Puccini, was Butterfly a particular goal for you?
Yes. For me, yeah, because, I mean, it's sort of like, it was a, kind of a no-brainer. I mean, Pinkerton is the tall American, you know. So right away, people were like, you gotta sing Pinkerton, you know? And it's become sort of a signature role for me. But yeah, I mean, yeah. So, and we always laugh, there's a moment where she says, you're tall, and you're strong.
Well, we're laughing about that in rehearsal.
Yeah, in rehearsal, he was laughing. He's like, yeah, okay. Well.
How do you view it in relation to what a role like Rodolfo, say, requires of your particular instrument? I mean, is it a whole different ballgame?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think that they're very comparable. I think most of the challenge with Puccini, and thankfully we have a great conductor, the challenge with Puccini, in my opinion, is always the orchestra, because it's there are some moments where the orchestra is so thick, so thickly orchestrated, and no matter who you are, I don't care how big your voice is, they will bury you. You know, and it's great to have such a wonderful conductor that's sensitive to that. And the challenge, and also, is Puccini has a lot of, especially Butterfly too, in this opera for both characters. There's a lot of big singing in the middle voice, and the danger is that you start to push too much, and you have to be very careful, and you have to have a voice that lends itself to sort of that bigger singing in the middle voice, and of course still pop up. But if you don't have the right kind of instrument, it's easy to really get too heavy in the middle voice for Puccini.
So in terms of the way it's written, Pinkerton versus something like Rodolfo, is it how do those vary?
I think it's very similar. Okay. I think you sing with the same way, mm-hmm. and you have to just be aware, you know, and not when that orchestra starts to swell, like in the third act of Bohème. You know, you have to just learn to just kind of trust your instrument and kind of ride over it rather than try to barrel through it. Mm. You know, and when you have a good conductor, you know, we were talking last night about in the third act of Butterfly, there's a great trio with Suzuki and Sharpless, and I've done it many times where the conductor is just stirring the soup and the orchestra just goes.
No, it's not just that, because the music is so intense and passionate that it's really, the player want to play.
They want to play, yeah. They want to play out. If you don't keep them down.
Keep and leave them calm.
Great.
And
he's great about saying, you can play, but
otherwise,
we have to hear them.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Marco, where do you place Butterfly in terms of the challenges that it presents to you by comparison to what you have to deal with in, say, Bohème and Tosca, which I assume you conduct pretty frequently?
Well, actually, conducting Puccini music, it's all, as Jim says, a relation by Butterfly and Bohème. For Pinkerton, actually, it's 123 pages in Act 1 in the score, mm-hmm. that is on stage, a sing from the beginning, and the entire act, it doesn't move from the stage. Then it disappears the second act and it's coming back the third. But in terms of longest role, I understand why you say it's the same as Rodolfo as well, because many people think Pinkerton is less important than Rodolfo because he's singing less. It's not true. Because at the end, if you value the pages and numbers and the note have to emit, it's mm-hmm. almost the same. But for me, Puccini music is from Edgar to Turandot, it's so intense, it's so beautiful. I don't like make a value, this is better than this, or this is worse than this. I think as in a composer time, he enveloped a beautiful way to target the heart of the people in any opera he composed. We cry for Mimi, we cry for Cho-Cho-San, and at the end, we cry for Tosca, we cry in any place. Manon Lescaut, Puccini always touch the heart of the people. And that is something really evident.
Well, he fell in love with every heroine, and you sort of hear
of
it, don't you?
He was a Latin lover. And oh, definitely, yes.
Read the history. It's pretty fascinating, the ladies that he was involved with.
It's actually funny. I want to say, you mentioned Edgar, and I forgot. When I was in graduate school, I actually sang Edgar in a concert version. And it was Edgar, I think, the second opera, I think.
Second opera.
Vili's first.
And Vili's first and the second opera.
Edgar's the second opera, and you can hear such, you know, it's still in his infancy in a way, but you can hear Manolo's what's school. To come. You can hear moments of all those other operas that are coming, you know. Oh, and it's one of the only operas, Edgar, where Tigrana is a principal mezzo role. Puccini didn't really write the Suzuki, but it's one of the only mezzo roles that has an aria and a substantial sort of prominence. For whatever reason, he didn't write for mezzo so much.
It's that in the Tirana and also Frugola in the Tritico.
Oh, but Tigrana's really big.
Tigrana's
you know
really,
that Marianne really McCormick strong. Or Suzuki actually recorded it.
Uh-huh.
She did. Oh, yes. I read that with Domingo.
No, with Carl Tanner.
Oh, Carl Tanner, yes. Okay, yeah.
It's one of the few recordings of the piece that exists. James, regarding this character, let's talk about the circumstances that Pinkerton finds himself in. I mean, in your first scene, you have a lengthy conversation with Sharpless, the American consul, and that's right before Butterfly arrives for the wedding. So in the course of that conversation with Sharpless, what do we actually learn about him?
Well, I mean, he's he says he's the Yankee vagabond, you know? I mean, he's young. He's very sort of spontaneous. He's looking to just, you know, he wants to have some fun. He's really not looking to settle down. He's not looking to completely permanently drop his anchor anywhere yet. You know, I think he's just he wants to see the world and smell all the different flowers and, you know, and he says all these things.
And drink
all the different kinds of wine and, you know, try the whiskey, try this. And, you know, he's just sort of a freelance sort of person. And he's not, he's here in Japan. And he's going to learn, and he's going to spend some time with this beautiful girl, and he's not looking to really be tied down.
It just occurred to me, you know, we have no sense of him as a person who does any work.
You never see him doing any work.
What does he do with himself?
That's what he probably does. He fills up his days with, you know, enjoying things and drinking and hanging out and trying, you know, date this girl, date that girl.
The Navy
you know?
Was a pretty good gig back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. You never actually see him doing anything, you're right.
So when he sings that the Ari, well, Amore Grillo, that's just about having a good time.
Yeah. Because there's a moment when Sharpless even says to him, "Well, I heard her voice, and she seems very pure, and she was talking of love." And I always like to play it when I hear him say that. Pinkerton kind of goes, "Well, it's not really love, but you know, it's life. It's not really love, you know."
The opera ends, as we all know, with the most glorious of all Puccini love duets. I don't think he wrote another one that can touch it, even in Tosca. So for you, Marco, what is the greatest challenge that you face in conducting that duet, which is what, about 15 minutes long at least?
Make the orchestra play soft. First, no, it's 15 minutes that I enjoy every single note and every single second. I can't tell you exactly what is the moment that I enjoy more. Probably the intimate moment when she say, "Vogliatemi bene." Yes, which means take care of me, love me. And Pinkerton, as you know, is young, blah, 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 they all say, James, he doesn't think too much. He just have a good time, and he think, okay, it's gonna be fine, and no problem. He doesn't think that is the drama of the poor lady, young lady, 15 years old, that he really feel in love, and she's ready to give her life completely and fight with the family, give up every religions and everything, just to be with this beautiful American guy. So that's mean in any moment. That's the intimated part of Puccini is always something special for me anyway.
And that's as intimate as Puccini gets in the love duet, isn't it?
Yes.
So she's so apprehensive with you. So what do you do in the course of that duet to make her feel more comfortable?
Well, I think it's interesting. The duet really starts and he calls her Bimba. You know, it's the first time he kind of addresses her, you know, little baby, and he's very sweet. And there's something about her, I think, over the course of the act that he's kind of sweet on her. And I think initially, he's really just looking to sort of get his rocks off and, you know, have fun and whatever. But then I think he kind of feels a little bit more for her a little bit. He starts to slowly have some feelings there. And he's sweet and he's kind of tender with her. And he gets kind of hot for her again then. But it's different. I think that there is that element of when I first started coaching this opera, one of my really fun coaches back in Philadelphia was like, you know, you keep saying Vieni, he wants to take her to bed. And he does. That is, I mean, obviously he's a young guy, he's driven by that too. But there is something there that he wants to sort of, you know, take care of her a little bit. She says, I've been orinagato, I've been, you know, my family has renounced me. And he's like, well, don't think about that. We're here right now, it's a beautiful night, let's just enjoy each other and, you know. So
in the moment.
In the moment, yeah. Yes.
Have you talked to any of your butterflies, the people,
my
the
leading
sopranos,
ladies.
Your leading
yeah.
ladies, about what Butterfly's previous experience with men before she got to Pinkerton has been?
I don't think she's that experienced, really. I think that she's...
Even being a geisha.
I think she's fairly new to this. You mm-hmm. know, she even says, you know, she talks about how she became a geisha, and it's... I think she's new to the whole thing, honestly.
So the big question, then, ultimately, is does he love her in his way, or does he not?
I think he does.
You think he does?
Yeah, because he really lived the moment. And in this moment, he really believed that...
In that moment, he
she's going to have a great time. And then he had to leave because he's in...
He's naive. He's not thinking about the future, really.
Yes.
He's not.
He
indicated that, too. He's living
yes.
in the moment. And I think that love is a different...
But he's really lived the moment. He really believes in the moment.
Yeah.
He doesn't think too much. That's what I said before.
Yeah, he's not thinking about long term.
Think about that long term.
He's a little mature in that way. And he's yes. in that moment, he does love her. He does feel like there's something about this. It's maybe an infatuation. I don't know. But there are intense feelings there. It's not just about getting her to bed. That is an element of it too. But he does sort of care for her.
The only phrase that makes me think about it's when he says, the day I'm going to marry the real
American wife. Yeah.
That's
what but he says it before.
But he says it before.
That's before
he
meets her.
Yes.
Yeah, before he meets her.
Yeah.
He talks about
talking
that
about the consul. And,
yes. he says, I'll have some fun now, but someday I'll have a real American wife.
Yes.
But then later on he meets
later
her,
on,
and he's sort of charmed by her a bit. And I think he
believes in it.
Yeah, I think in that moment, I think he's genuine in that moment, yeah.
It's just incredible this is the first that they've met. I mean, Goro made the arrangements for her to marry him.
Yeah.
But this is the first that they've met. We always have to remember
Actually, Goro is the bad one because he's really...
The marriage broker
we're
talking about.
Yeah, because he sells all the girls from the tourists coming on town.
Mm-hmm.
And even to the consul says, hey, I have a bunch of those, only 100 yen.
Yeah. I've done productions where Goro has a picture of you,
and
he rolls out the pictures.
Longer,
he says, which girl you want? Pick one, you know?
Pick one.
Like Leporello with the catalog.
Yeah, kind of.
There's a major element of this opera that never really gets talked about very much, and that is the conversational passages, the importance of conversation in this opera. So, Marco, I figured that you have to work with singers as carefully on those sections of the score as you would if you were coaching singers in, you know, recitative in Mozart. So what are some of the points that you stress in making singers comfortable with being conversational in singing Puccini?
Yeah, especially, you know, first of all, I insist very much on diction, on the word. I think not because I'm Italian, but I think the Italian language is very special in the way you say the things. I mean, you can say the same sentence in the so many different ways and means different mentality and different. I mean, it's so rich, our language, and in this kind of conversation, it's very important. And I learned that from Renata Scotto.
Oh yes,
because
what did she say?
Was so perfect in diction. and she was loving just to work in La Parola, express the intention of the word, and that's make the conversation logic. If you have the right diction, if you say the right thing in the right way, it's make the feelings go in the conversation go in a natural way. And this is my goal. I mean, I really insist to, in the same way I work in Mozart recitative. It's not any difference.
Mm. James, when you started out singing in Puccini, did those passages come naturally to you, or did you have to sort of concentrate on? Because it's a small portion of these operas that are, you know, pure lyrical outpouring, but there's so many purely conversational scenes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you just study and working with native speakers. And,
but
you
have a perfect Italian diction,
and
actually.
And I have a good ear, so, you know, I'll work with somebody and, you know, he'll give me a note and he'll say, no, it has to
of course,
be,
yes.
Blah, blah, and then I instantly can remember
right
it.
Right away, yes, he catches it.
And I catch it and say, oh, yeah, okay, I hear that accent there. The emphasis has to be more there, you know, or double that consonant there. And so, yeah, I think it's, I mean, like anything, it just takes study. I'm not a native speaker, so it took time, but it's in my blood, so.
Mm-hmm, yes, yeah. I assume that, yeah. So going back to the second act, there's one hugely important passage in the opera where Sharpless is trying to read to Butterfly a letter that he has received from Pinkerton. He doesn't get very far, but we only hear a couple of lines of it. So, James, what might be in that letter, do you think?
That's a good question. we had some discussions about this, too. I like to think that, I mean, this actually relates to later on too, when we talked about why is Kate there and what, how much do they know and whatnot. I think that this letter, in a way, is, you know, maybe he and Sharpless have quite a bit of correspondence. Maybe a few letters have been exchanged over the years, and Pinkerton maybe feels it's like a loose end, and he's like, oh, he can kind of handle it. He'll kind of deal with it, and I'm just going to kind of do my thing here. And but, you know, maybe I like to think that there's a whole correspondence happening, and that Sharpless told Pinkerton that, yeah, you have a son. There's a child here. I like to think, because there are no definitive ways. Does he know? Does he not know? This relates into later what we talked about too. When he arrives in Japan, yeah. Is his intention to take the child? Why is Kate coming with him on this naval boat? You know, all these things that we talked about in rehearsal. You know, maybe Kate can't have a child, and so in the correspondence she said, "We're going. We have to go get this child." And I want to keep tabs on him while he's there, and we're going to go together, and we're going to do this and tie up this loose end.
Marco,
what do you think? I don't know. That's what I'm saying. It's open for discussion, really.
Yeah, actually, this is one of the major questions in Butterfly, because it really doesn't have an answer. It can be like that, but I believe in other way. Okay. I think Pinkerton wrote this letter to Sharpless just to be good and keep it calm, everything. Go to Chojo-san, say, I'm fine. I mean, he obviously remembered that moment, the passion moment he had in the past. But she actually showed up the son during the letter, so he doesn't know there is a son. That's the point.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Because at a certain point it says, you should prepare her to my welcome back. Maybe he wants to have some more fun. Why not? Or some more other moment. I go back to Nagasaki. Oh, there is Chocho-san there. I remember her. Why not?
Yeah, yeah.
It's typical Italian.
Why does Kate come back, do you think? Why does Kate come back with
her? Yes. But no, then Kate come back to get the child.
So Kate does know, but there's not much time,
that's
though.
That's
it's a very short time. I mean, it would take them months to get there. So if Kate, you know, they would have to know some, if that was the intention, you know.
Probably you told already to Kate that you was engaged with somebody in Japan.
Yeah. And then she comes with me, and we arrive there.
Exactly.
And then Sharpless says, hey, you have a child.
Sorry, Kate, but there is a little problem more. There is a little kid, yeah, 43 years old.
No, that could be it. Yeah, we talked about all this. It's really not clear. Because it is very strange that Kate comes on this naval ship and she comes with me for months. Mm-hmm. Why is she there? You know.
And the certain point says, okay, we have to take care of the kid.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's interesting too because Kate, you know, if she did just find out, she's very calm. And really,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, if she just found out about this, and why would she be so quick to say, "Oh yes, we'll just take the child"? Yeah, right.
And
you know,
and I'll treat him as if he were my own. She says,
"Yeah, that's why I always thought they must have known. The intention must have been for her to come to take this child."
Yeah, but my question is going to be happen the same if the kid wasn't born?
That's it's a good question. Would she still have come to Japan with him?
Or she's gonna kill herself anyway.
Ah, you think so?
I don't know.
I
think so.
And I think another thing I wanted to say quickly too, in relation to the child, people always ask me, "Oh, Pinkerton, you know, he's not the most sympathetic character," and I always get booed when he did Pinkerton. And people always say, "Why is it?" And I think it's because of the child. I sing the Duke a lot, Rigoletto, and he's, for all intents and purposes, he's also a bad guy. But the Duke never gets booed.
The
Duke is the guy that all men want to be, in a way. You know? And Pinkerton, you know, he has the same free spirit. And like Scarpia, yeah.
Escarpia.
But Pinkerton, because there's a child involved, it changes the dynamic, and it makes him more loathsome, in a way. You wonder if Gilda had a child, and the Duke, maybe that would change the whole dynamic.
I'm sure it would.
Yeah, but there's a child involved, and it's a good question. If the child wasn't born, would Kate have come? I don't know. We don't know. They're not definitive answers. But
going back to Puccini's orchestra for a moment, what does he do to create Japanese atmosphere in this piece?
Well, the harmony. The harmony are so evidently. You know, there is one. I used to conduct a lot in Japan. I held an orchestra for 5 years there in Tokyo. And the first concert we play, I remember that it was a very famous piece in Japan, a leitmotif that everybody knows, like O Sole Mio in Italy. And it's called Sakura, Sakura, da di 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 da di da da. I say, oh God, this is Butterfly. So it's not Butterfly. That's the influence of Puccini from there. So he picks some leitmotif from the ground in Japan, and he enveloped the beautiful harmony. And this feeling, he fell in love with the harmony, with this kind of harmony, and it put in any opera some Asian.
That's in the thing.
Tosca,
quel barattolo,
for example. Yes.
He uses that melody in Butterfly.
Are there particular identifying themes anywhere that he applies to particular characters?
Yeah, because Puccini was very detailed in that.
Can you sing, hum, or whistle any of the themes?
Sharpless.
That's his Anderson Act too.
Leitmotiv. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
What does he? Does Pinkerton have any identifying theme?
Dun, 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 yeah. Right? I was saying.
Absolutely, yes.
And we hear very, I don't know how many times in the course of the piece, we hear what she sings at her entrance. Spira su mare, su la terra, that. Do you think that Puccini uses that one too many times, or is it always appropriate? It's always appropriate. Because we really do hear it a lot.
I was scanning all the Puccini opera in 1 second now. It's impossible to answer right away. But I think...
You mean in the course of this opera, you mean?
Yeah.
No, in this opera,
in this opera.
Just that. Mm-hmm. I think...
You think he uses it too much or no?
No.
No, I think it's great, yeah.
Because we hear it,
it's familiar.
Yeah.
It's the love theme.
I sometimes refer to it as that.
Yeah.
Interesting point, yes.
There's a point that came up in a discussion that I had with one of our previous Pinkertons at Lyric, Frank Lepardo, and I think it's important to get James's take on this. That is, the whole idea that we have to place some of the blame for Butterfly's situation on Butterfly herself and stop laying it at the feet of Pinkerton, that he's not, he is not the total reason why she is in the trouble that she's in. So where do you come in on
well,
that
Well, I mean, I think an argument could be made for that, sure. I think that she made her choices, you know. I mean, she could have easily married Yamadori and been taken care of, and she chooses not to. She chooses to give up her family and her religion, you know. He didn't ask her to do that. Pinkerton didn't make her do those things, so. But, you know,
But that's typical for a Japanese woman. A Japanese
to
character,
do that,
oh
yeah.
My God, yes. They, when they decide one thing, they go to the end. to the end. Yes, really.
So I think that could be, there could be made an argument for that. I don't think you're going to have too many that are going to agree with that, but I think she's definitely made choices, and she definitely took part in this whole situation, but she expected him to react in another way. You know, she thought he would be the man of her dreams, you know? One thing I've learned, you can't expect somebody else to react the way you want them to. That's something I've learned the hard way in my trials and tribulations of love.
Mm-hmm. when Pinkerton comes back in Act 3, how do you... You have an aria where I suppose it's possible to create sympathy for him. Can you?
I think so. I think in the original, they made him rewrite that.
There was no moment of remorse.
And basically all the tenors said, I don't want to sing this.
No.
So Puccini had to redo it. Because they had to give him some moment of like, okay, there is a heart there. There is some sympathy. There is some kind of remorse in there. So. Do I think that I think absolutely. I think that that's actually something that I really try to do in the third act especially is to show that he's matured a bit. He realizes it's right in his face. Wow, I was off doing my thing and, you know, and she was waiting for me this whole time. Like, he feels like, my God, it's overwhelming actually, you know, that he's confronted with that. And he does feel remorse. Yeah, he says, I'm a coward. I can't even deal with this right now. I'm like, yeah, it's a lot.
Doesn't he call himself vile? I'm vile.
A coward, vile. Yeah.
When they come on, I'm trying to think what the dialogue is when we first see him when he comes on in Act 3, because the aria comes at the end before his exit.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, what he says?
To Suzuki, be quiet, be quiet. Don't wake her up yet. You know, not yet. And then, how does she know that I was here? How does she know I was coming? You know.
Yeah.
And he's sort of.
Suzuki says
she's watching every ship for the last 3 years.
For 3 years, yes.
He's like, God, really? God, she really. And look at these flowers she put out to welcome you. This is really sad. Like, she's been waiting this whole time. And this is she's. And you know, he was naive to that fact.
Mm, right. Now, Marco, you had mentioned the first version. What sort of revisions did Puccini actually make?
In Butterfly.
Five versions.
Wow. The first one was in Brescia.
First revision?
It was a disaster. You know,
But it started at Scala.
Yeah. But the version of Brescia was the famous one that was bad. And I did this version. You too,
yeah.
Right?
So I did parts of it, not the whole thing, but
okay.
Yeah. Some of the changes they do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I find it interesting. It's not a big difference, actually, but there are specific moments more underlined. And some ones, it's very, very interesting that in the Act 3, that Kay Pinkerton doesn't sing...
Son la causa
innocente della, but it's,
which means
it's the sharpless.
No, but you translate what you just said.
Son la causa innocente della vostra sciagura, perdonatemi. It's like forgive me. I didn't know that. I feel guilty. But
I'm the innocent reason.
Innocent reason. And
for your suffering.
The same phrase is made from Sharpless.
Now in the version today, Sharpless sings that line.
Yes.
In the first version, Kate sang it.
Kate sang that.
Now Sharpless sings that line.
Sorry, I am the
She said, "I am," and Al Sharpton says, "She is the cause of your suffering." Yeah. So just one little
just line. Just a little difference. And when they did again, he changed for 5 times.
I have never heard the music. There's an uncle who has a little sort of arietta, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yakusi de.
Yeah.
So, and he cut that. So yeah. have you done all of that?
No, I didn't do that.
But have you heard any of that music? No. Because it would be such an incredible distraction to have a relative of butterflies in that first scene who has a little moment.
That little moment. But that was typical at the time when the composer does composing an opera, then it depends on the opening was, and they start to change. We see the Verdi stories, wow, it's amazing how many versions this opera, from La Forza to Boccanegra to Trovatore, to everything was changed for different reasons. Made in French, in Italian, we're talking Carlo. About Don Carlo. Don Carlos, 5 act, 4 act, so many changes. Actually, Don Carlo is interesting because it's one of the opera that is more changed. Yeah. Because it was French first, with the ballet, without the ballet, 4 act, 5 act, 5 act in Italian, 4 act in French, 5 act in French. They say, wow, but all the versions are great.
Yeah.
And any kind of music you put in Don Carlo is good. It's great, it's fantastic. It's like, wow, it's like, why the
whole thing? But not the case with the Puccini's, you're saying. But
Puccini. Details
Uncle
was little.
Is not his finest music.
The thing was amazed me in Tosca, for example, that Visidarte was insert after, like Addio Fioritasil in Butterfly. I mean, this make.
How can you have Tosca without Visidarte?
Yeah. And now Tosca, we recognize Tosca. We think right away Visidarte, before all the rest, because it probably is probably the most famous leitmotif in Tosca.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
When it comes to food for thought, what do you think this opera has to say to an audience in 2013? What does it have to say about human beings?
You answer.
Me first. Wow, okay. Was that on our preparation
sheet?
Yeah. I
don't
think I saw that question. Wow, that's interesting.
Interesting.
I think it's... Well, I mean, for instance, the story, they've turned it into, they've updated parts of it. They've done this M. Butterfly, play where the guy falls in with the allegation and finds out she's actually a transvestite. And they've done it in Miss Saigon, which I think you mentioned at 1.2, and, which people, there's still mass appeal to that. And I think that it's sort of the different cultures coming together, which people can relate to. Especially now, there's so much more of that, and the world is becoming smaller. And I think that there's a certain appeal. The story maybe, at the time it's set, it was a crazy thing to think about having a Caucasian man and an Asian woman together and having the offspring, and it was sort of a taboo thing. Now it's maybe audiences are they're more accepting of it. Like, oh, okay, well, But it's hard to imagine that at the time this child would have been shunned by both cultures because it doesn't belong technically to it belongs to both. But I have many friends that are mixed race, and they talk about even now that they feel like they can relate to both cultures equally, but sometimes they're not sure which one is really theirs. It's kind of so.
We need to talk certainly about the strengths of this particular production. What do you most enjoy about it? This is Michael Grandage's production that originated at Houston Grand Opera and that has also been seen in Geneva. And it's a co-production with our three companies.
Well, to me, it's very efficient because Butterfly doesn't need too much. It's already there in the score, in the story, in the character. Of course, we need a set, we need a beautiful atmosphere, and I think it's very pleased to me, all what I saw during my
it's very beautiful.
Conducting. I
think
it
doesn't distract.
Exactly. So much time we did,
some of the similar ones.
Crappy productions, sorry to say that, but especially because sometimes it's happened to me often, but when I conduct in one piece and it look at the stage and doesn't respond to what the music I play, I feel useless. I feel like, I say, why I play this music is not matching with the stage.
Yeah, it's not beautiful.
This is not the case, of course.
This one is very
good. Glad when there's something, I'm a classical person, and I love to play the music matching with story, and everything have to be together.
The aesthetic has to match, I think.
Exactly. And that's the
only way. This one's very beautiful, and it's like you said, it's rather simple. But it tells the story, it's efficient, it complements the story, it doesn't distract at all. And I appreciate it. I've done some crazy productions where, I'm a naval officer, I should wear a uniform. I've done some where I'm not even wearing a uniform, there's no house.
No.
I'm like, but we're talking about the house. Oh, just imagine it.
Imagine.
I'm like, well, but he's talking about opening the door and things, so I mean, how can we just, it doesn't match, you know?
I was gonna ask you about both of you, because you both have such experience with this piece about off-the-wall productions, because Butterfly has been updated fairly frequently. For example, have you done a production that took place in Vietnam, in contemporary Vietnam?
No.
Or the Vietnam of the 60s, I've read about that.
I haven't personally.
Have you done but some updatings generally?
Not updating. I've done sort of abstract weird things. Not specific time period things, yeah. But, I don't know.
Not exciting on Butterfly, no. I can say it did not happen to me.
Yeah.
Thanks God.
I've done some very, very difficult, where, you know, sort of very specific, the director wants a certain aesthetic.
Yes.
And that's difficult.
It's difficult because if you don't believe in it.
You don't believe in it, you feel like you're
like
you useless.
You have to do anyway. Yeah. You feel like,
what am I doing here?
What about interpretations that are, as opposed to what the visual side is? I mean, that speaks for itself. But as far as changing your character in a way that maybe suited you or maybe didn't. Have there been situations where you said, well, Pinkerton isn't like this, or Pinkerton, I can't believe that a Pinkerton should do this. Have there been situations like that?
I'm trying to think with this piece. I've had that with other pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, I don't believe so. Nothing's coming to my mind, but I've definitely done productions where, you know, they could show me the costume and I'm like, well, what is this? You know, why do I look like a clown? You know, I mean,
really?
Yeah. Or ones where I look like Jesus, you know, Jesus Christ. And I'm like, what am I wearing here? You know?
I've read a bunch of reviews where they've made him like a fraternity guy, like in a sweater with a big letter on it, you know, this kind of thing, and sneakers.
Well, I mean, I guess I could see how that might work, but I don't know. But that's the thing, you know, we don't have any say in those things at all.
Exactly.
We show up to sing the music, and sometimes the first day of the presentation, you're like, oh, it's going to be a long month, you know? So I was so happy when we got here and we saw, I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful. It's normal. I have a nice uniform. We don't have a lot of crazy things happening, you know, so.
Now, Marco, you've spent lots of time in Japan. James, have you been there also?
I've been 4 times to Japan.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what does this experience of being in Japan, what sort of effect does it have on your feeling for this piece, your understanding of it?
Well, I personally, when I walk around Japan, I'm the tallest person there amongst, you know, a sea of, you know, black hair. And, you know, you feel it. You feel like an outsider. Thick black hair, like Pinkerton does. He's rather amused by all these different things. And he's sort of like, look what they're wearing. And, you know, he's looking at, you know, look, she's wearing these sandals and, you know, and so you feel that. You feel that when you're there. You know, I have to take off my shoes? What do you mean? I go to sit down at the table and I'm like, you know.
Obviously.
You know, yeah. And so you feel that, you know, and even in the
did
moment.
Did you ever do the tea ceremony?
Yeah, I was going to talk
That's
about the
great.
Tea. Yeah,
yes.
The tea thing, you know, which she, and we have a moment where wow. I, in the opera where we have a drink and there's a whole custom to it.
You turn it a certain way.
And if you don't do it the right way, it's kind of an insult.
It's mean different, yes, yeah. It's a kind of insult.
And you know, like for instance, in the opera, there's a moment where she hands me the drink, and I kind of, you know, he's got kind of big hands, and he's got this little cup, and she's like, no, you got to put your thumb in, and he's like, oh, I got to, okay, put my thumb in, and I got to drink this, and you know, he feels very uncomfortable, and I've experienced that, you know, where I'm trying to do what they do, but I'm not made for this little table, this little cup, you know.
Have either of you performed this opera in Japan?
No, I didn't do it in Japan. Butterfly? No.
Not Butterfly.
Have you ever performed it with a Japanese butterfly?
Many.
Oh, yeah, really? Many Japanese butterflies.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what does
a Japanese butterfly bring to the role that a Western singer might not? Do you automatically sense that it's just, that there's this level of authenticity?
Yeah, I would say. I sang one of my favorite butterflies that I've sung with. She's Chinese, but it was Liping Zhang, who's very petite, and she has a youthful look about her, and she's just, you know, very beautiful, and she's one of just aesthetically and also vocally she's fabulous. But just she just looks like, you know, I just want to pick her up. You know, she looks like she's this little.
She's small.
Been asked to pick up a lot of your butterflies?
Oh yeah, I always ask. Can you take off your shirt? Can you pick her up? Oh okay, whatever. All right, you know.
You sing the high C and then you pick her up.
There's actually a video. I did a butterfly with a Japanese soprano, Mihoko Kinoshita, and this was many years ago in Detroit. And Mario Corradi, was it? You know Mario Corradi?
Oh, yes.
He was the stage director. And he's, you know, he was very fond of me. And he said, oh, I want you to take off your shirt in this moment. Vieni. So I did. There's a video online of me, like, at the end of the duet, I have no shirt on, and I'm singing, you know. And, you know. It worked, though. It worked in some way, but, you know. But he insisted. I said, all right, whatever.
Now, you mentioned Miss Saigon. Have either one of you actually seen it?
Sorry?
Have you seen Miss Saigon?
No.
James, have you?
I've seen it, yeah.
Did it speak to you at all?
Well, of course, there's a famous scene at the end of Miss Saigon when there's a live, like, life-size
helicopter
lands on stage.
Yes, I know
that's
kind of famous. I never saw
it. Did it speak to me? Yeah, I think so. There's a song about, there's a whole song about the child, Buidoi or something, about the mixed child and about how it's going to have a difficult life and all this kind of stuff. And so it kind of relates to what we were talking about before.
How close is it to the plot of Madama Butterfly?
I think the character, I think his name is Chris in Miss Saigon. He's less hateful. They kind of made him less of a bad guy. Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but I remember that they kind of made him a little more sympathetic.
But there wasn't anything in the score that you would have ever wanted to sing, I assume.
No. it's not my thing, so, you know.
But it's interesting that the Broadway world took care about the opera things, like Miss Saigon is Butterfly,
and
Rent is Bohem.
Is Bohem, yeah. But I always want to say,
and they took the theme from the humming chorus is used in Les Mis.
Yes,
bring him on.
Yeah, yeah. Da, 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 oh right,
is the humming chorus.
Humming chorus.
Yeah.
There's also, isn't there a section of Fanchula del West first act which comes straight from Andrew Lloyd Webber, or did Andrew Lloyd Webber
Andrew
from
Puccini?
He took from him.
Surely yes.
Surely. Yeah.
Surely yes. Yeah. I mean, Fanchula is one of the most Broadway show in the opera world.
I wanted to ask both of you if you have any ambitions in Puccini left. Are there Puccini pieces that you want to do, whether James, in your case, maybe 5 years from now, even 10 years from now, or tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And Marco, you've done a lot of Puccini, but are there still Puccini?
Almost everything.
Yeah.
Almost. I didn't do Le Villi, I didn't do, I mean, apart from some concert or arias or little pieces of the Edgar, but I didn't do that. From the rest of the opera,
have you done Tritico, Rondine?
Tritico is one of my, I think it's the perfect combination of everything. I mean, from the drama, the Tabarro, from the struggle of Sor Angelica to the totally changed in Janis Kiki. Mm-hmm. It's the most genial piece of work in opera history, I think.
So, James, you could really do probably in the course of your whole career, you could probably do virtually the entire Puccini repertoire.
Possibly. I mean, I'll be doing, in the next couple of years, I'll be doing my first Tosca, so I'll be adding that. I would love to do, in 10 years from now, I'd love to do Manon Lescaut. I think it's amazing. It's an amazing opera. That's one I'd love to do. And one of my favorite operas, I may never sing it, but I just love Turandot. I think it's just, God, it's one of those operas where, of course, everyone knows Nessun Dorma, but listen to the riddle scene. I mean, my God. And then the whole first act is just, it's such an amazing piece. Every time I go hear it, I'm like, this is like the perfect piece, you know? So maybe 10, 15 years from now, maybe I'll pump out Kalaf, you know? Who knows? Why not? Yeah.
These gentlemen have had a long last 24 hours, you know, opening night and post-performance celebration.
Post-performance longer than the opening.
Yeah. So I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful to both of them that they were able to be with us this evening, and I want to thank them very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Backstage at Lyric. For more interactive content and to purchase tickets, visit lyricopera.org.